Hello and welcome to Autumnal Hoxton Square in East London. Last month, we began our new occasional series on writing about place with a discussion about the singular Orcadian poet and novelist George Mackay Brown. Today, we have a very different podcast for you about antiquarian and rare bookselling. Now, as you'll know, if you've joined us before, we record this podcast around the kitchen table at this little publishing house. So the editorial team round us are getting on with their day job of producing the slightly foxed quarterly magazine, and you will hear them typing away or answering the door or even, with luck, putting the kettle on. The two foxed editors, Gail Perkis and Hazelwood, are here. My name is Philippa Lamb, and we have an expert on antiquarian books with us. Before I introduce him, let's have a quick roundup from fellow fox Hattie Summers on what's going on here at the magazine this month.
So we're all gearing up for Reader's Day, which will be in a couple of weeks now at the start of November, first weekend on the Saturday at the Art Workers Guild. The tickets come out May, June and sell out within the month.
So no tickets for this year, but next year it's annual, yep, isn't it?
Absolutely, and there are about 90 tickets, so you have to get in there quick.
And we're also, Hazel and I, just polishing off the winter issue, which has got some lovely things in.
Issue 64,
including an article by our guest, who's written a lovely piece on Patrick Hamilton's The Slaves of Solitude. And we have one of the funniest articles that we've ever had, which is about the cookery writing of Fanny Craddock, is just priceless, as indeed was she.
Indeed,
yes. We've been doing pieces on Olivia Manning's two trilogies, and we've got onto the Levant trilogy now, and it's a very good piece on that.
We've got, Henry Jeffries on Going Solo, which is our new edition for the winter, to follow on from Roald Dahl's Boy. Going Solo is his sort of adult memoir, his time in Africa and the RAF.
And when's that published?
That'll be at the end of November.
Yeah.
And I think a little trumpet blowing is in order, isn't it, Hazel?
Yes, well, we have a triumph to report. We featured in the Sunday Times 100 Podcasts to Love, and we were high up in the book section, so we feel, well, slightly patting ourselves on the back about that.
I think quite justifiably. Yeah. Well done.
We're in very good company, you know, backlisted, we're on there, and Literary Friction, which we're obviously big fans of.
But just
in the
three
office.
Book podcasts, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Very pleasing. Thank you very much to everyone who might have suggested us. So on to this month's guest, Chris Saunders of Henry Sotheran Rare Books and Prints in Mayfair. And rather neatly, the reading from the Slightly Foxed Archive this time is a first-hand account of setting up a second-hand bookshop in the Cotswolds. We'll have book recommendations from everyone later on. But first, Chris, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your shop, if I can call it a shop, Henry Sotheran, it's the longest established antiquarian bookseller in the world, isn't it?
It is. We started in 1761 in York, moved down to London in 1805, and we've been in the sort of Piccadilly, Strand, Mayfair kind of area ever since. We've been in our present building since 1936, so we're pretty well established.
Very beautiful shop, too.
Well, it is. Thank you for saying.
Well worth a visit if you happen to be in the centre of London. It's gorgeous. And the early origins of the business, I mean, some extraordinary collections of books and libraries passed through the hands of the company.
Yeah, I mean, all sorts. Charles Dickens' library. When John Gould died in 1881, we bought his entire estate, which we've still got quite large remnants of, and which has formed the basis for a lot of our print dealing throughout the rest of our history.
This is the ornithologist.
Yeah, he left a whole stack of coloured plates, uncoloured plates. We've got a long history of dealing with really big things, and the Folger Library, which is one of the greatest libraries in America, bought a lot of their sort of Shakespeare folios from us in the 19th century.
Yeah, and I was seeing in the 80s, the final draft manuscript of Gilbert White's Natural History of Selborne.
Yes.
That's quite something.
Rather special.
I mean, Gail would rather like that.
Who did that go to?
I wish I could tell you.
Oh, okay. What a shame. No, I was in Gilbert White's house very recently. There's a lovely museum there.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And a lot of editions of Natural History of Selborne.
I think it is the most, apart from the Bible, reproduced book in the English language.
Well, it is.
So there are hundreds and thousands of editions. The reason I can't tell you is that I can't remember.
Oh, right. Okay.
Not for confidentiality.
It's
long before my time, I'm afraid.
Yes. Can we just clear up the difference between antiquarian and secondhand?
It's a fine distinction. In antiques, I often talk about antiquarian being more than 100 years old. And that is kind of the cutoff, sort of pre-1900. You would think of being as antiquarian, which isn't to say there are some very, very valuable 20th century books, which calling them secondhand sounds a bit
derogatory.
But antiquarian really is sort of 1900 and beyond.
But you do deal in rare books as well, the sort of thing you just alluded
to. So, I mean, so some of the modern first editions can be extraordinarily rare. Something like Casino Royale, for instance, the first Ian Fleming James Bond book, they only printed 500 copies because they had no idea it was going to be so popular, most of which ended up in public libraries. So to actually find a copy, you know, it's hen's teeth stuff, and hence it's incredibly expensive.
That brings me on to my next question, actually, which is about condition, because obviously we all have old books and we often, you know, dig up something which we think might be valuable. But as you say, things that have been in libraries, however small the print run was in the first place, are they still valuable even if they're in tatty condition?
It would depend on the book. Generally, not really. If you're a serious collector of modern first editions, you want them in as pristine condition as possible. So ex-library books are often so much less valuable than they would have been otherwise. Which is a shame, but...
Yes, and the books are the books, aren't they? But the collectors want them to be absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great part of it, is things have to be as good as possible.
Do collectors actually read them?
Depends on the collector.
I've got visions of somebody sitting there with white gloves.
We do have some collectors who will buy three copies of everything. So I'll have one reading copy, one to go on the shelf to show people, and one to go in the locked cabinet.
Oh, my God. Seriously?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. Terminology. I'm a great fan of this. I mean, we all know what slightly foxed means, I think, now.
We do.
Where do you want to start? I mean, there's more jargon in antiquarian books than probably in, like, computer programming is the only thing that comes close.
Such as?
Well, there are the sizes of books. You've got folio, quarto, and octavo. And all that is the size of a book depending on how the paper's been folded to make the pages.
Right.
So a folio is a big piece of paper folded once to make two leaves. Quarto, fold it twice to make four leaves. Octavo, fold it three times to make eight leaves. So it's quite a simple thing, but then it's expressed in, you know, eights and fours and things in descriptions, and it looks like algebra and people feel a bit weak at the knees. So for some people, it might be a bit intimidating.
And bindings? Presumably there's a lot of
good God.
Jargon around bindings. I mean,
there's that wonderful book, you know, Ronald Searle's Slightly Foxed, yes, but Still Desirable. Yeah. And there's a glorious image in that of, I think it's half Russian, and he's got a picture of half a Cossack dancing.
Right, yeah.
What is half Russian?
It's a form of leather binding.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, my favourite term is cockling. Sometimes you see on an old book that's cloth bound, there's a little bubble underneath the surface of the cloth. Not very serious, but it's lovely cockling.
And presumably it affects value, does it?
A little bit. It's just a nice sort of cosy word.
And the paper itself, I think I read somewhere that you think of old books as having this particular smell, but you don't really want that because that means it's very cheap paper.
Yes and no. Actually, one of the things when people come to our shop, they often go, oh, this smells lovely. And you don't like to say, well, what you're smelling is the inevitable degradation of all the paper in the shop. But it is a lovely smell. Different paper stocks deteriorate at different rates, and that's what foxing is the acid in the paper reacting to humidity in the air.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the same book, you'll see different paper stocks. Things like handmade papers can add a lot of value to a book because they're beautiful.
Yeah.
Years ago, it seems to me there were a lot of antiquarian bookshops like Charing Cross Road in central London. They mostly seem to have gone. Why is that?
The internet, I'm afraid. Shops that are actually sort of open shops like ours, there are probably around 10 still in central London, because there's still a few on the Charing Cross Road and Cecil Court. There are other big dealers who don't really have an open shop. They're more like sort of office-based, or they work out of a townhouse or something.
Yeah.
But lots of the independent traders who had a little shop, they just can't afford the rents and the overheads anymore, because, you know, Amazon and whoever have undercut. So there are lots of antiquarian dealers still, but lots of them are operating from home and doing book fairs and stuff.
So you can't browse in the way that you
used
to. But book fairs are a wonderful way of seeing a wide variety of collectors, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
And I mean, they happen all around the country.
You can find one virtually every week, really.
Antiquarian rather than just secondhand.
There are the two big ones in London. Then there are Tunbridge Wells, you know, Canterbury, York. There's a big one at York
Cathedral
this weekend.
Cities.
Has it affected the price, the internet?
Yes. In a way, it's made the trade much more honest, because now it's really easy to go online and see what everybody's charging for a book. And so where you used to get people chancing their arm and putting massive prices on things, it's just not possible anymore. Mm. It works both ways. Sometimes people who are trying to sell a book have done a lot of research and think they know how much this is worth. And you look at the book and it's not worth that because there's something wrong with it or whatever. And you end up with, my book's worth this much because I saw it on a website from someone in Ulaanbaatar or something. And you're like, oh.
I'm interested in the people who buy and, well, their motivation, really. Are they collectors? Are they investors?
There are probably three different groups of people who buy. You get the serious collector, so they may have an academic interest in, let's say, Darwin, and they build an amazing Darwin collection. We've got a few of those. You get the people who buy not necessarily one theme, but maybe they love 20th century literature, and so they'll build up a really good collection of 20th century first editions. And that's not an academic thing so much, it's more maybe sentimental. And then you get the casual buyer, and we still get people who buy things every now and again because they fancy it, or they're buying things as presents. We don't really get people buying for investment, because a canny investor will not be buying books, really, because books quite often hold their value, but if they go up in value, it's very slow.
Really?
So if you're buying for a quick return, books is not the place to go. You'll be looking at modern art or property or whatever. It's not a quick buck industry, hence you don't see many millionaire book dealers, alas.
Absolutely, I'll simper this.
I had an author at Murray's called Peter Hopkirk, who started a collection on Central Asia. I mean, and out of that collection came some wonderful writing from him on The Great Game.
Yeah.
And I know that he eventually became paranoid that he was either going to be burgled or flooded or have a fire. And once he'd finished, he wrote six books, he sold them at Sotheby's, and that auction was so well attended. And I think, you know, made over £1 million.
Yeah, I think we probably bought some stuff from that sale.
And I think the provenance that it had come from his library probably added to the value.
Absolutely. If you've got a good library from an established collector, someone who's an expert in the field, that can absolutely add value.
Why? Because it's the same book, isn't it?
It is the same book. But when you buy an antiquarian book, there's a kind of sense you're buying into a story. You're not just buying a book. You're buying into a culture, a provenance. You know, this is the book that was used, say, by Peter Hopkirk to write this. You're participating in that sort of bit of cultural history.
And I suppose dedications and things like that.
A book signed by the author dedicated to someone with a letter. I mean, again, that really adds to the story. I mean, people buy these top-end books because of the story attached to them sometimes, as much as the thing itself.
There was that film called Can You Ever Forgive Me? What did that ring even remotely true with you?
Absolutely.
What was the story here?
The story here is that it only came out last year, and it's based on a true story, and it stars Melissa McCarthy as a failing author. She can't write any more books. She's got complete writer's block. She's absolutely strapped for cash. And she finds some old letters, and she manages to sell those from an author. And she gets a bright idea that she's quite good at forging. So she just starts writing fake letters and selling them to dealers. I mean,
Has it been done? I bet it has.
Yeah, of course it's been done. She did it. I mean, it's a true story. She got caught in the end, but while she was doing it, she made a really quite decent amount of money.
Buyers seemed a bit sort of casual to me, but
I think it's more a case that if you buy something off somebody once and it is kosher, the next time they come and you think, well, I can trust that person.
Yes.
But she was an author, so she might have known all these people. That kind of thing is a wake-up to the industry. I don't think people are quite as casual as they were. That film set, I think, in the 80s.
Chris, you produce some very beautiful catalogues, which I'm pleased to say we get.
In fact,
I have a screen around my desk which is entirely from cut out pictures and illustrations, a decoupage from your catalogues.
Really? Very gratifying.
They contain an enormous amount of research, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
How long does it take to compile one?
We are currently doing a literature catalogue that will come out next month that's probably take us 6 months to do. Mm. It's not all done by one person. There are two or three people writing the descriptions. And sometimes it could be very quick. But for the more expensive or more interesting or valuable books, there could be quite a lot of research done.
And what sort of things would be featured there?
You get a physical description, so you know exactly what you're getting as well as the picture. It would tell you what edition it is. If it's an important book, why is it important? What's its place in sort of history? And if it's got an association, then we say who it belonged to, why that person's relevant, how they fit into the general story. I mean, antiquarian books selling is a great job for somebody who really likes research, as well as selling and the commercial stuff, because actually going through the books and working out why it is important is so interesting. You find these amazing stories.
And you're still mostly selling to individuals?
Mostly. We do quite a lot with institutions.
Universities?
Libraries, those sorts of people.
Do they digitise them?
Some universities are very, very hot on digitising stuff. Yeah,
I mean, it's fascinating, that, isn't it? They then become a thing that millions of people can see.
Yeah,
you know, rather than just a few people handing around after dinner.
And certainly, in terms of sort of academic future, that's great, because it means that people who otherwise wouldn't get to see them you don't have to flog off to a library somewhere in Iowa to see a book. You can just turn on your computer.
Yeah, it did strike me that's really changed the market, hasn't it? That technology has completely changed it.
What it means is that academics individually buy less. They can read them online. Institutional buying has changed a bit because I went to a big conference in Baltimore in June of American librarians, and a lot of them are buying stuff to use as teaching aids. So they want old rare books, but they have to be interesting from a like a printing point of view or a presentation point of view, because they're going to use it to show to students. So rather than buying maybe a first edition Dickens, which isn't particularly interesting to look at, they would buy something with more visual appeal. And that's where it's changing. Books are becoming a teaching aid rather than necessarily a repository of information, because the information side has been taken over so much by the internet.
And are there new trends in the wealthy individuals? I was thinking about, I mean, Chinese antiquities are now shooting up in value because Chinese collectors want their own stuff back in their own country. Is it the same with books?
We don't really find that. There aren't that many Chinese books that come through our hands, to be honest. Mm. None of us speak Chinese.
Very
so you can't really sell a book that you don't understand. But the Chinese customers we get tend to be looking for the Western classics. So they'll be the people buying a big set of Dickens or Shakespeare or whoever, often because they're buying property in the country and they want to have a good British library to go in their new home. The biggest sort of foreign market for us at the moment is the Middle East. We've got a lot of Middle Eastern customers wanting travel or history of that region. There's a lot of really good British material on that region, obviously, given the history.
That's interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that. What about the other great kind of big economies, Russia and India? And
I mean, we have big buyers from all of those places, not following a particular pattern, though. Mm. They quite often buy big, expensive things because they're important or they look beautiful, and that seems to be what they respond to.
What about fashions in collecting?
Yeah, I mean, things do go up and down. We always do quite well with Kipling, for example, but recently we get more and more asked, well, wasn't he a terrible imperialist?
You know,
those sorts of things. Yeah. So the political makeup of the time does affect collecting. Mm. I mean, people like D.H. Lawrence, who sort of 10 years ago, hugely popular, has now less so.
I think people have questioned his reputation, haven't they?
Yes,
I mean,
they have.
You know, I mean, he was, I suppose, in the 70s, was incredibly popular because he seemed to break boundaries on sex.
And he seemed to be about sexual repression.
Exactly.
All that kind of
and
thing.
Now we're all a bit beyond that. I would have thought he'd slipped definitely to the second rate.
But social norms and politically unacceptable views, they impact on whether things are collectible.
Absolutely.
So the Enid Blyton effect?
There's a little bit of the Enid Blyton effect. Interestingly, we are able to sell quite dodgy material to very respectable institutions because there's such
a... Do you want to rephrase that?
But, for instance, the Little Black Sambo books, which are obviously no one would produce those now, they sell to institutions because there's such an interest now in researching that material, why it came about, who was writing it.
Because it's academically interesting.
Yeah.
What about erotica?
We are so close to Soho, but we don't really do very much of that.
That is a very specialist market.
It is really specialist, yeah. And we don't have anybody racy enough to get into it. Because, I mean, yeah, there's absolutely bundles of it.
And a long history.
And a long history of it.
Are there certain areas you won't touch?
We won't really stock Nazi stuff because there is a market for that. But do you really want to attract the market for that?
Absolutely not. No.
So there are things that I'm really wary of going there, yeah.
So I have to ask about the acquisition you're most pleased about.
The one that had the most sort of Le Carré-like romance attached to it was an amazing second edition of a 1555 book by Vesalius, who was the founder of modern anatomy. And the lady who wanted to sell it was in Paris. And I had to go to Paris on the Eurostar, met her for about 15 minutes, and she was a sort of Siberian heiress attached to the Sorbonne who'd bought this thing years ago at auction. 15 minutes with her, agreed terms, got it back, took it on the Eurostar back to London, actually back to my house where it stayed overnight, then back to London, and within 2 weeks I'd sold it, and it was £100,000 worth of book.
Wow.
And it was the most amazing turnaround of a book of that value.
That's fascinating. And who
bought it?
Yes. It ended up going to an American library.
Did it? Yeah, so, my husband would have had that one off you straight away, except possibly for the price tag. Yeah.
Well, you know, if I find another one. It was just, you know, going to Paris in this sort of sweeping across Europe way.
Yes, how
doesn't
romantic.
Happen very often. Yeah. That was very exciting.
Chris, how did you get into it?
Well, like most antiquarian book dealers, purely by luck. I just finished a PhD, and my openings after that seemed quite limited. and I was doing all sorts of jobs I really hated. And so I wrote off to various people just saying, have you got anything? And Sutherland's at that point had a vacancy for a Saturday boy. Considering I was 30, I was a bit old for that. But I took this temporary role.
Were you sweeping the floor and emptying the teacups?
Basically, or? Yeah. But I had another job at the same time, but I was doing this on Saturdays. Then after 6 months, somebody left. And there was a full-time job. And 15 years later, weirdly, I'm running the place.
So you built up your knowledge over the time. Obviously, you had fascination before.
Yeah. I mean, my background's in literature. And I came in at a time where there wasn't really anybody doing natural history. But we had some books come in and someone had to do them. And from that, you know, you build up. I mean, I'm still learning all the time, but that's how you build up through experience of looking at stuff.
The natural world's a big area, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I concentrate sort of the 19th century. So Darwin, Wallace, Huxley, that group, plus the amazing sort of illustrated stuff, because we have this John Gould estate, which is all beautiful bird books. Huge kind of Audubon-like
Audubon,
things.
Yes, yeah. The big one, isn't it? Well, tell people about Audubon who don't know about Audubon.
So he was an American naturalist and painter, early to mid-19th century, who really invented American ornithology and created these absolutely gigantic books of American birds. He wanted to produce everything life-size, which is interesting because some of those birds are huge. So the books are at least a metre tall, and you'll have something like a flamingo, which he does life-size by bending the neck round into all these weird contortions so he could fit it onto the page.
But somehow they were huge.
It look incredibly... They're not really lifelike. They're very stylized, but they're so dramatic, and so beautiful.
Weren't they released plate by plate as he did them?
In sort of groups of plates, yeah. Okay. He couldn't do a whole book in one go, because not only was he the naturalist, he was also the painter. So he would produce them in parts, and they would go out to subscribers, who would then be able to bind them up into the full volumes. So there are, I think it's 7 volumes, and the last set sold at auction last year for something like $9 million.
Wow.
So Gould is like the British Audubon, who slightly later followed in that vein. Didn't do his own painting because he wasn't a very good artist. So you had people like Edward Lear and his wife Elizabeth Gould, plus others, would actually produce the paintings. But again, he's really responsible for the ornithology of Australia. He went to Australia and did a huge book on Australian birds, which no one had done before. So these two characters are particularly very exciting because they're really opening up the world scientifically and also producing some amazing artworks.
It's a gripping field, it really is.
My husband is a small publisher, among other things.
Oh, right.
So the first thing he does when he opens a book is to look at how many times it's been reprinted, you know, when. I wondered if it had sort of changed your relationship with books
It becomes a reflex. I always look at publication dates first.
Yes.
Yeah, I can't help it.
I do that.
I always look at the publisher, and particularly in second-hand bookshops. Mm. I go along the spines, and if I see... I mean, there are certain publishers I always think they had a very good list and they're worth investigating.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, yes. So it must be the same for you, but on a wider scale.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. It's always interesting when you find a publisher you've never heard of.
Quite often a bad sign.
Yes.
Didn't last long.
Yes.
I think I just haven't asked you, actually, which is the obvious question, is who's selling? Presumably in the past it was impoverished aristocrats and...
Yeah. There's less of that because they've all sold their books. Probably our main source is people who have been collectors who are now approaching the end of their lives, really, and want to get rid of their collection, either because they're downsized and they've got to move to somewhere smaller, or they realise that their children don't understand or aren't interested in their collection, partly because they're afraid that the next generation will just stick them in a skid. Or they just don't want to land their kids with the hassle of dealing with something that can be quite large and that they just don't understand.
Technically complicated. Yeah.
So we get quite a lot of books from those sorts of people. There's always a lot of dealing within the trade and from auctions and things. Quite often we will buy something off a dealer they haven't got a customer for because it's so specialised, but we've got that customer.
Presumably in a business as long established as yours, you literally handle the exact same books.
You do sometimes see things coming back to us that have got a little Henry Sutherland sticker in them that we sold to somebody in 1893 or something, which is really nice, actually. Yeah. It feels like it's come home, but you don't want it home for too long, obviously.
Obviously not. I was reading around this subject and I realised that people are still trying to create the antiquarian books of the future, aren't they? I think J.K. Rowling produced an extraordinarily expensive limited edition of 7 handmade copies, the Moonstone edition. That's not new, is it? People have done that before.
No, I mean, people have always produced some massive deluxe version of whatever.
Does it work?
Not often. The problem is that predicting what's going to be important in 100 years is impossible. You take as an example Charles Lever, who in Dickens' time outsold Dickens, considered to be a better novelist, more important, etc., etc. Who's even heard of Charles Lever?
Yeah, I don't know that. Does anyone know the name?
No, never heard of him.
Okay. I've never read any, but I'm assuming there's a reason why his books aren't read anymore. At the time, people would have thought maybe that now Charles Lever would be having museums named after him and stuff, but the J.K. Rowling thing, she personally doesn't have much stake in it becoming an antiquarian item because she'll be long gone. It's a great way of making lots of money now.
Though I think in fairness to her, I think she gave them away.
But whether they hold their value, you'd be a fool to predict.
Yeah, I mean, that is extraordinary. You should say a novelist of such standing and none of us round the table have even heard the name.
No.
Can I just ask, we've obviously talked about reputations rising and falling. We've noticed with our Slightly Foxed editions, which are limited editions, that obviously when we sell out, that's it. And we go on to Abe, the secondhand book platform.
Okay.
And, you know, you'll see a copy of a book that we published maybe 5 years ago selling for £80.
Really? Mm.
So people are collecting them not just because of the content.
If you put a limitation on something, then there will always be people who go, oh, I must have that. And at some point that will begin to translate into a nice bit of profit.
Just not to us, unfortunately.
No, that's the problem.
Did you keep a set of all your own books? I really hope
yes.
so.
Oh, yes. We actually have in the archive, we keep copy number one of every one that we do.
Okay.
And at some point or other, we will sell them as a set.
Well, it's a difficult one. We find people selling copies of our catalogues online, and we give those away. Yeah, that's really cheeky.
They are very beautiful catalogues, and I do recommend them.
Oh, thank you very much.
I guess we should wrap this up. There's so many more questions in my head. I think we might have to have you back again. Stay with us for a book recommendation. First, though, let's move on now to our reading from the Slightly Foxed back catalogue. Gail, what are we going to hear?
We're going to hear a delightful account by Glyn Frewer of how he, in retirement, set up a second-hand bookshop in the Cotswolds. I think it was a haberdasher's, and he cleared out all the shelves, and he opened shop, and he did it for at least 10 years. It's charming.
My father was a bibliophile, and I cannot remember a time when I was without books. It was inevitable, therefore, that I should want to own a bookshop. After 30 years in advertising, I bought a small haberdashery in Stow-on-the-Wold and replaced its racks, previously filled with anoraks, rolls of fabric, shooting sticks and Wellingtons, with bookshelves. Onto those shelves went about 1,000 books that I'd already amassed. I sat at a small desk facing the door and the window, where I displayed a selection of Come Hither titles. A cowbell jangled bucolically every time the door opened, a cigar box served as a till, and a tobacco tin held coins for change. I was ready. Customers began to trickle in, pleased that a second-hand bookshop had opened in the town. Many came with bags filled with books they had been waiting to get rid of. And before long, I was being asked to visit the homes of people to help them clear out books. I generally had little difficulty in judging how to price them, but I wasn't always right. An Indian booklet called The Art of Taxidermy, Mounting the Tiger. I had priced it 50p. A lady seized the book from the shelves with a cry of delight. How extraordinary! These two brothers stuffed all my husband's trophies. I must take this. How much is it? I indicated the price. Is that all? I'd have paid £50 for this. Thank you so much. The cowbell rang out the departure of one satisfied customer, and now I had a coin to rattle in my box. But I'd also learned an invaluable lesson. If such a book could sell in Stow-on-the-Wold, it proved there was a buyer for any and every book. It was just a matter of bringing the two together. From then on, I bought esoteric books I would previously have ignored, and I never regretted doing so. I quickly learned which categories and authors I should concentrate on. I reduced the amount of fiction the charity shops provided greater choice. I enlarged the countryside and children's sections, and increased religion, cookery, history, and biography. I learned that demand for the works of Scott, Thackeray, Galsworthy, and Hope was negligible, but that there was a ready market for Jane Austen, the Brontes, Dickens, Hardy, Trollope, Waugh and Graham Greene. Poetry was always in demand. I kept 2 shelves of uncategorised books so that customers could make their own discoveries, and I filled boxes with postcards, bookmarks, cigarette cards, old photo albums, even a set of glass lantern slides. As the years went by, my enjoyment grew. I enlarged the shop and added more shelves, increasing my stock capacity from the original 3,000 to 10,000. In my second year, I had my most successful buying coup. A newly arrived librarian at a long-established boarding school wanted to clear out the Victorian leather-bound tomes to make room for new books. I was invited to make an offer. The outcome was several carloads of sets of The Edinburgh Review, Household Words, Punch, the Encyclopaedia Britannica and the Quarterly Review, as well as works by Ward Fowler, Richard Jefferies and W.H. Hudson. I soon sold them all. One aspect of the book trade I had to learn from scratch, first editions. Fortunately, I subscribed to Book and Magazine Collector, which gave current market prices and prevented me from making serious mistakes. Chatting with collectors themselves taught me a lot. A first edition had to be pristine, without a blemish, and the same applied to the dust wrapper. I sold a fine first edition of Golding's Lord of the Flies without a jacket for £40, and later an identical edition with its pristine jacket for £240. There were two aspects of the book trade that made me uneasy. First editions of children's books fetched a high price, yet to me it seemed that children's books were meant for children. I also wasn't entirely happy about selling books with hand-coloured plates, most commonly found in pre-20th century natural history books, to customers I knew were print dealers. They would sell the plates individually for anything from £10 to £50 or more. Their argument was that more people would enjoy the plates on their walls at home than would ever be likely to see them in old books, but that argument did not ease my conscience. These aspects apart, what possible reason could I ever have had for giving up this life of bibliophilic bliss? There was no single reason, but I did have an increasing sense of foreboding which clouded my vision of the future. More and more customers would find a book they wanted and then say they would just check it out on Amazon. It was time to ease myself out of this wonderfully satisfying and enjoyable occupation. I sold my business as a going concern, and I hope that this kind of shop will continue to have a place in the world, albeit a smaller one than hitherto. For what other way of life is there where you can pursue your love of reading and where you know that anyone who steps over the threshold is a kindred spirit?
Now that, of course, raises a whole bunch of questions I wished I'd asked you earlier. And actually, the one that's uppermost in my mind is this issue about esoteric books, you know, buying weird and wonderful books because you know you've got someone who you think might buy it.
We quite often buy esoteric books knowing that we don't know anybody who wants to buy it, but assuming that it's so bizarre that someone will buy it.
That's quite a fine judgment, isn't it?
The bizarre stuff quite often sells because there's something irresistible about, you know, my favourite title ever is Earthworms and Their Allies. Which was a book that I bought, and it took quite a while to sell, but the person who bought it was massively happy. So, you know.
What about this moral dilemma of cannibalising books for print?
Well, it's not a dilemma for us in that we don't do it. We do sell prints. I mean, we're spoilt, really, in the terms of the Gould, because they were all unbound to begin with. We deal a lot with sort of modern Japanese prints, which aren't bound up, and we deal with travel posters, which obviously aren't bound up. Obviously, things are offered to us that were once in a book. If they come into us in that state and they're beautiful, then we'll buy them. But we do not buy books to split them up.
Presumably other people are less scrupulous.
Yeah, and if you sell a book to somebody, you have no idea what they're going to do with it.
Well, that was Nigel Anthony reading a piece by Glyn Frewer, and it was Slightly Foxed issue 42, that one. We will have book recommendations from everyone shortly. First, a word about the Slightly Foxed quarterly magazine. Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for non-conformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors, and since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Recommended reads, preferably something our listeners can find and afford. Gail?
Well, I'm reading a new book by Laura Cumming called On Chapel Sands, which is the rather remarkable account of how her mother, aged three, was kidnapped in 1929 from a beach in Lincolnshire and was found some days later, 12 miles inland. It's the story of why she was kidnapped. Extraordinary, really, because it was Laura's mother who was kidnapped. Her mother herself never really knew very much about it. But Laura investigated, and of course all the locals knew far more than they were letting on. It's a remarkable detective story. It gives a wonderful evocative picture of that area of Lincolnshire, very flat, of course, very isolated. And Laura Cumming is the art critic for The Observer, so she also looks at photographs and images of the various protagonists and brings an art historian's eye to it. It's very revealing and beautifully written.
I think I heard that dramatised on Radio 4.
Yes, it was.
Hattie.
I picked up a book the other day that I've read a number of times now, and it's actually the first book that I bought in a second-hand bookshop. It was a copy of Amanda Foreman's Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire. I think she was married to the fifth Duke of Devonshire.
She was.
They were the ones who started calling, you probably know her better as Georgiana, which
yes.
is what, because they had this bizarre affectation they all picked up.
And so
they
that wasn't a common thing. It was just their
I
family
don't think
way
so.
Of pronouncing.
From what I read.
Okay.
But she's just a fascinating woman. And I think it's probably the first biography I read as well. And now I'm obsessed because I'm naturally a nosy person. And I like to know a lot about people. And it got turned into a film with Keira Knightley and all that kind of stuff. She just had this amazing kind of political mind. It shows that there are a lot of women operating as these political machines behind the scenes. Yeah, very much so. You know, she's not by any means the heroine of the story. You know, she was very troubled. Lots of other things were going on for her. Amanda Foreman ended up getting access to all these letters and things that were kept at Chatsworth, but a lot of stuff was obviously got rid of as well because it told a bit too much. So it's kind of piecing together the story.
Hazel.
Well, I've been rereading two books by Christopher Isherwood, Mr. Norris Changes Trains and Goodbye to Berlin. I mean, they are about a society that's kind of in meltdown. They're set in the early 30s and just before the Second World War. I don't know why I was drawn to them at this particular moment, but anyway, I'd forgotten, you know, what an incredibly funny writer he is, apart from the Hills. You know, there's a great sense of threat in both of them. But Mr. Norris is such an amazingly wonderful character with his wig and his powder puffs. A complete rogue, but impossible not to like, because he's also so sort of oddly vulnerable and nervous and anxious about what he's doing. I mean, a dreadful informer and so on. That's the first book. And then the second one moves on to sort of sketches, really, of life in Berlin. And it was made into a play, I Am a Camera, and Cabaret the Musical, the very well-known character of Sally Bowles, who's living there, and a Jewish family, the Landauers. The narrator, Christopher, is there teaching English in a sort of slightly random way to rich families, and it's a lovely description of the poor Landauers, who, of course, you know, meet a terrible fate, most of them.
Well, very poignant.
Terribly poignant. This very memorable picture of a society that's going down the tubes, really.
Chris, no pressure, obviously, but we're all very, very interested in that.
Well, I've recently come back to a couple of books I've read over the years, which are Helen Thomas's memoirs of her life with her husband, Edward Thomas, called As It Was and World Without End. They've been reissued in various guises. I think it's now called Under Storm's Wing, which is a kind of a combined edition of them. They're such honest books. He was a very difficult man. He found it very difficult to express love or even feel love. But what comes through is how much she loved him. And it's just a lovely testament to her strength of will, her strength of personality, her understanding of him. She put up with an awful lot of basically nonsense from him. But she does it all with this huge generosity of spirit. Another character, another person who comes into the book is Eleanor Fargen at a late stage, who is clearly absolutely besotted with it, Edward Thomas. I don't think they actually had an affair, but he clearly quite enjoyed the attention. And she is so understanding of that relationship.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, she's an extraordinary woman. Very humbly written. If you're interested in Edward Thomas, it's very interesting to find out about the softer side of him. His male friend, people like Robert Frost, sort of denounced these books as making him emasculated, more or less, because she obviously was so in charge of his life in many ways. Beautifully written, very simple style, very tender. Yeah, so it's something I come back to quite a lot.
Thank Thank you, everyone. That's all we have time for this month. But Chris, thank you very much indeed for being with us.
Very welcome.
You will find a link to Chris's beautiful establishment, Henry Southern, on the Fox website, foxquarterly.com. Details of all the books that we've mentioned today will be in the show notes attached to the episode on your podcast app as usual. You can find those on the website too, along with all the Slightly Fox books. And if you're tempted, the application form to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine as well. We will be back on November 15th with a podcast about English nature writing. Thanks for listening and for joining us on another bookish hike off the beaten track.